Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Alpha.
And I'm Stephen.
And on today's New Statesman podcast, we discuss the reshuffle and you ask us about Stephen's interview with Keir Starmer. So we're recording sort of in the aftermath of the main reshuffle events while junior posts are still being decided. Some of the biggest moves were Dominic Raab being moved from Foreign Secretary to Justice Secretary and being replaced by Liz Truss in that great office of state. So that was one of the biggest moves. And then something else that has got people's heads scratching is Nadine Dorries as Culture Secretary. And as well as that, Nadeem Zahawi has gone from being the Vaccinations Minister to heading up the DfE. What do you two make of it? You know, you've been looking at some of the biggest moves.
I think probably the thing to think about first is actually how interesting it is that it even happened, because this has been rumoured for quite a while that Boris Johnson knew he needed to have a reshuffle, had kind of planned one. And there were points over the summer and also last week where it was definitely going ahead. And then it looks as though he personally got cold feet. So Stephen has had very strong views on this, that maybe Boris Johnson would never get round to doing it, which, even though disproven, I think is completely true to what we have observed of him over the past few months, that this is a prime minister who doesn't really enjoy sacking people. I had a conversation with someone earlier talking about a story they've heard about Boris Johnson trying to sack someone at The Spectator years ago when he was editor. And I think he didn't end up sacking that person. It went very differently. Some of the story is redacted. And so I think it's interesting that clearly he has decided to go for it and to risk ruffling a few feathers and cracking some eggs, basically, mainly to promote people who've been loyal to him, which is just such an interesting theme, because the problem that Boris Johnson has faced is that he's seen as a winner by his party, but he doesn't have a team of sort of loyal people who've been with him for a long time or from a similar school of thought. He sort of borrows support from parts of the party, and they lend it because they think he can continue winning. But we've seen him rewarding that loyalty. So I think that's the first takeaway.
Yeah. Alva, obviously, having doxed the number of times in our office in Parliament, when I would sometimes quite literally put down a phone to like someone in Downing Street, like, they're claiming there's going to be a reshuffle. Never going to happen. Never. Because, as Alva says, right, it's not that those two earlier reshuffles were journalists getting their thing facts wrong or people getting mixed up. You know, the actual machinery of government had geared into reshuffle mode, and he'd twice gone, oh no. And I think Alva is exactly right. And one of the central things about this reshuffle, the really interesting thing, is just not only that it happened, but the thing which links all of these people, right? Nadeem Zahawi has been a Boris Johnson backer for essentially the whole of his time in Parliament. Actually, he was a backer of Boris Johnson when he was, you know, just like, you know, a very wealthy and successful businessman who was looking for a parliamentary seat and helping support, you know, Boris Johnson's mayoral campaign. And I think in some ways, the important thing to understand about this reshuffle is, in some ways, it didn't start yesterday for two reasons. One, it didn't start yesterday because there were twice serious reshuffles where he went, okay, I know that we've marched everyone up the hill, but do I really have to like do this? I prefer not to. But also because in many ways this reshuffle begins with the moving of Kwasi Kwarteng to Secretary of State for Business. Why have I decided to try and give myself the essay question of remembering what BASE stands for? Let's just... BASE, Secretary of State for BASE. Now, of course, Kwasi, again, is a long-term Boris Johnson ally in what is a major delivery-focused department for them. Right. The climate crisis is obviously a major delivery-focused department because we will all die in the climate wars if we don't get this fixed. But it's a major delivery department electorally because... one of the things we're lucky about in the United Kingdom is the overwhelming majority of voters know that we need to fix it, and a large chunk of them really, really care about it. And then what he's done in this reshuffle is essentially, if you think about all of the big departments that decide elections, right? Priti Patel, obviously, at Home Secretary, he can't move her. She has an independent power base. I mean, I, you know, not to once again do my theory of like, I don't care what the polls say. I'm sure the polls are right to say that she's very unpopular on her own, and I think if she led them into an election, they might struggle. But she, I think, is an integral aspect of their sort of... I think having someone who people see as being so authoritarian and mean probably convinces like the median voter, and they go, okay, well, they've got her, so actually they're probably slightly more reasonable than she... He couldn't move Priti Patel, so he's stuck with her at that major delivery department. This is why I think the junior post is going to be quite interesting, because... I imagine that we will see a sort of Johnsonite essentially there as Priti's minder in that very important delivery focus department. Nedima, education, Kwasi Kwarteng at BASE, as I've said. Truss, again, someone who had backed him, you know, very early doors in 2019, backed him in 2016, goes to the Foreign Office. But also, crucially, you can tell that he still maintains his sort of political allegiance to her, because what he's also done is he's allowed her to maintain the Women and Equalities Brief, which will allow her to continue making her sallies into culture war issues, allow her to roam freely across sort of the Westminster brief and scene, which will mean that she will be able to continue her sort of meteoric rise and her, you know, establishing of herself as a real power player in Tory politics. And what it really reminded me of actually was in 2001 Tony Blair put in his, what he described as his four reforming ministers, David Blunkett, Stephen Byers, Alan Milburn, Estelle Morris, into education, transport, home affairs, and another department, health. And he said, I want you to be here till the end of the parliament because you guys are going to do the stuff which gets me elected. Now, the fun fact there is that none of the four did make it to the end of the parliament. So things can go wrong, but this is very much that type of reshuffle. Genuine Johnsonites in the delivery departments. You know, as in a very good piece that Alva and I wrote, you know, someone said to one of us, you know, she is of Liz Truss, she's a deliverer. And this is very much, you know, the march of the deliverers.
Yeah. And I think Michael Gove being moved to housing is an interesting example of that as well, because I think there's been a little bit of like confusion about what that move necessarily means, because that department, MCLG, you know, communities, local government and housing, doesn't sound glamorous. It doesn't sound sexy. When he was at the Cabinet Office, you know, he was across a range of different things. But I do think it's a sign of that reforming and also that focus on the domestic agenda that's going to get Boris Johnson re-elected being played out with that move, because someone like Michael Gove with a brief like that is going to be so different from Robert Jenrick. You know, he will have to bring sort of decisive action to that department, not only on the planning reforms and where they're going to actually build these houses, how they're going to level up without pissing off a lot of their voters, but also on the cladding crisis as well. That was a very big part of Robert Jenrick's bad reputation among the public as well. So it'll be interesting to see how Michael Gove grasps that brief, because I think he's got kind of like a cross-governmental role to deliver levelling up as well, which we all know there's a bit of confusion within government itself what that actually means. There's been this suggestion that it's actually about potential and opportunities and jobs rather than, you know, making individual places better. And I think in some of the focus grouping and the polling, ministers are starting to see that what needs to happen is actually making the areas where people live look different, and it's got to be tangible. It's not got to be about the sort of macro figures about jobs and skills. And so I think there's a suggestion there of making the housing department the kind of levelling up department, putting Michael Gove in charge of that, suggests that they are leaning more towards the latter rather than the former. So hopefully we'll see, you know, in the next few weeks whether or not that confusion clears up.
I'm confused by the Gove appointment, and I think we kind of should be confused by it, because you could interpret it two ways. So yesterday quite early on in the reshuffle, a source who'd been right about pretty much everything said, I think Michael Gove will be going to MHCLG, the housing department. It's not a glamorous role, but I think he really wants it. He has stuff that he really wants to do there. And then that turned out to be completely true. But the bit that I'm unsure about is how much that is spin or sort of getting out ahead of the story and insisting that this is something that Michael Gove was seeking. I think that there was a genuine sense that he wanted a proper brief rather than the cabinet office role. But whether he wanted that brief is a kind of different story. And there's just a question as to, you know, privately, what does Boris Johnson really think of Michael Gove? You know, does he see him as an ally or as a rival or both? And, you know, is this a sort of poison chalice, this department where there are so many huge challenges with the housing crisis, with the cladding crisis, that it's going to get worse unless it's really tackled? Or is this actually, you know, putting one of the people who really does drive reform in whatever department he touches, putting one of maybe on that level, one of the best cabinet performers in the difficult brief to sort it out? Maybe that's actually a really smart move. I'm still undecided on it. And I think, you know, you would just have to buy Michael Gove a few drinks or Boris Johnson a few drinks to see whether he deep down is happy with this new role. And also Boris Johnson deep down, whether he really trusts Michael Gove or not.
I suppose it's like a big responsibility. It's basically delivering a manifesto commitment, isn't it? The levelling up stuff. So it suggests a respect for his skills as a minister. But at the same time, it ties his fate to quite a politically difficult thing to tackle.
I was speaking to a senior Conservative who kind of sort of said, oh, they said, well, it's a perfect marriage, which I put in the piece. But what I cut out was them saying, but we all know that some perfect marriages unravel when the couple realises they want slightly different things. Because their point was, right, is it's a perfect marriage and it's a department which has a lot of stuff that Conservatives would like reformed, and you put Michael Gove anywhere and he does, you know, a lot of Conservative reforming, right? That is his thing. However, it does also take him out of this role where he was essentially, you know, kind of acting as, you know, the kind of, well, I mean, essentially as the de facto deputy prime minister, allowed him to have his fingers across a lot of pies. Now, even Michael Gove's allies will say to you, you know, I love Michael, but, you know, he loves nothing better than to roam across other people's briefs in cabinet, you know, whether it was, you know, beefing with Theresa May over Trojan horse, beefing with, we've been Jeremy Hunt, then Jeremy Hunt over education, over health when he was at education. And so it feels to me unlikely that part of this isn't about Boris Johnson's anxiety about, you know, the fact that Michael Gove is perceived as someone who always schemes. And also, I think what's interesting is, you know, before this reshuffle happened, I was talking to a close ally of Boris Johnson's, and they said, you know, the thing I've basically seen in my time in politics is they said the schemers never prosper. They said, you know, Osborne would have been better off just trying to be a good chancellor. If he'd been focused on being a good chancellor and not scheming, he wouldn't have done such a sort of punitive budget before the referendum, this person said, which was great news for us as leavers, but he shouldn't have done it, right? And they said, you know, Gavin Williamson spends all of his time scheming. He's a rubbish education secretary. And then the interesting other two names this person then said is they said, Rishi's spending too much time scheming. And they said, Michael spent too much time scheming education and always has a scheme on the go. So I think part of it is this feeling for, you know, for Boris and among his closest allies that Michael has always had a scheme on the go and they would therefore like to curb him. And it's interesting that as the replacement in that, you know, helping this prime minister with some of the administrative stuff, and he doesn't have perhaps the kind of flair and passion for them we usually associate with the PM, is Steve Barclay, who is ultimately a wholly owned subsidiary of Boris Johnson. Not in a, like, he's a particularly loyal kind of way, but, you know, if Steve Barclay was sacked tomorrow, the Conservative backbenches would not sort of rise up. So it exactly allows Boris Johnson to have someone who can be his representative on earth, who he's not going to be frightened about giving him that power. So essentially, one of the problems that anyone in that brief has is Jenrick's tenure was basically like watching someone run around a like firework factory, lighting little sort of matches on timer strings. And now he's sort of, and now you're like Michael, like, hey, good luck in the factory. Because you say there's leasehold, there's cladding scandal, there is just a whole bunch of very difficult things. And you can easily see how, from Boris's perspective, it is a perfect marriage, right? If Michael Gove can turn his administrative eye to fixing these problems, great. But should Michael Gove's career be caught in the explosion, that's not such a bad thing for Boris Johnson.
I thought it was interesting what you said about Steve Barclay, actually, because moving the chief secretary to the Treasury now is quite a weird move in my eyes, because we've got the spending review coming up in autumn. And, you know, you saw Robert Buckland, who was the Justice Secretary until yesterday, in his resignation letter, he basically made a big dig saying, you know, there's no price for justice, you should invest in it more. And it's been really unhelpful how underfunded it's been for years. And so you'll have all of these new ministers moving into these departments, which we know, according to, you know, the most recent budget and according to what we know about the upcoming budget, are facing sort of day-to-day cuts in their spending. So, you know, I don't know what you think, and maybe this is too conspiratorial, but is this sort of a move on Johnson's part, or like a convenient sort of side effect on Boris Johnson's part of this reshuffle, that you will have these new ministers who won't be able to be there defending their budgets in quite the way that ministers who have been embedded in their departments, like Robert Buckland, would have been able to do in the coming weeks, especially with Steve Barclay not there anymore and that position changing as well?
Steve Barclay is and was regarded as one of the real kind of the last remaining austerians in the parliamentary party. Obviously, the budget itself is quite austere, but, you know, most of them are austerity nimbies, right? They go, you know, yes, 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 taxes must not rise. Yes, 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 debt must fall. My leisure centre? Is that a joke? Yeah, it's not the first time that there's been a reshuffle midway through a CSR, but I think actually the real reason was just that they delayed twice, and then if they were going to do it before conference, they were sort of running out of time, and clearly it was very much a kind of, okay, you know, we are, he clearly resolved he was, you know, going to put his hand in the briar patch. But I think you're right to single it out, because one of the things which, you remember that period right at the start of the coalition, when they just like agreed to a bunch of like obviously highly unpopular cuts. Yeah, like, you know, it's the selling off of forests, you know, the various kind of, that very difficult first year they had. Yeah, in cash terms, all of the money that would have been raised by those really unpopular cuts happened, but most of those year one cuts didn't. Well, why did that happen? Because you had a bunch of new ministers who kind of went, oh yeah, sure, that seems like a good way. We're all new here. I'll settle with the Treasury fairly quickly. Yeah. I think then it feels to me that what this has done, even though, you know, there is, in no government, there is no greater spending department than number 10 Downing Street, and particularly in a Boris Johnson-led Conservative government, there's no greater spending department than Downing Street. So I don't think he'll have sat there going, oh, this will make Rishi's life easier. Let's do this. I think we've got to do it at some point. But I think this hugely increases the chances that someone will sign off a cut that they really, really shouldn't have done. Right? I think the chances, you know, they will, yeah, and again, yeah, only 2010 fans will remember this, then they will try and sell off some forests or, you know, something else, and just obviously not a good idea politically. I think it does increase the sort of already quite high risk rating than the CSR has for this government.
And one last thing I think we should discuss before we move on to the next section is Nadine Dorries and what it says about Boris Johnson's focus on, you know, squeezing the culture war kind of, I don't know what to, the culture war sponge. You know, she's someone who has said controversial things in the past that are now being resurfaced by people on social media, and she doesn't usually apologise for the things that she says. And, you know, I mean, when I interviewed her a very, very long time ago, I remember she was sort of, and it's similar with lots of these ministers who have been successful under the Johnson government. She was sort of seen as like an eccentric, an outsider who would, you know, who would sort of throw pot shots to the inside, you know, calling David Cameron and George Osborne posh boys who don't know the price of milk, but also just generally being a sort of very much an independent, eccentric character. And I feel like Liz Truss and some of those other free marketeers had that reputation as well. So it's, you know, just as an aside, it's interesting seeing them being at the heart of power now. But I wonder what you think of her appointment. Do you think this shows that Boris Johnson is sort of wholeheartedly leaning into the culture warrior stuff that Oliver Dowden was doing in that post, but even more so?
I mean, I think you're completely right that even when she was appointed as health minister, I think that there were real questions as to whether she would be able to do that job. I think because people had really just seen her as kind of crazy, pretty much, like just to be blunt about it, especially as you say, there were so many sort of digs on Twitter and kind of eccentric comments. That was always the way she was seen. And I actually think she has impressed people as a minister. Like, she didn't do a bad job in that health brief. And, I mean, certainly when you look at the performance across government, I think that, she's thought to have done an okay job, basically. Then it actually comes back to what we began the podcast on, which is Boris Johnson basically rewarding people who have supported him from early on. He doesn't have very much of that. And I'm sure that it's lonely in the top job, especially if you're someone like Boris Johnson who doesn't have much of a natural power base. So I think rewarding people like that as you move into the trickier part of your term in government makes sense.
There is now a lot of actually administrative stuff in DCMS, which now includes its weird silent D of you know, digital as well as department. So it has the whole of like the sort of digital transition stuff. It has all of the stuff about Channel 4. It has a whole bunch of stuff about culture. And yeah, if you imagine this reshuffle as kind of a game of, you first have to select out MPs for whom, you know, like, have they been successful administrators in their departments? And then you're also then going, you know, were they people who backed Boris Johnson in 2016 and 2019? Or were they people in the kind of, you know, I would rather chop my arm off than have him be prime minister? I'm sorry, wait, the what? The Brexit Party have taken how many votes in my seat? So anyway, let me talk about chopping off this arm. Like, if you imagine that that's sort of the exercise, right? Nadine Dorries is kind of inevitably a name in the frame there. I do also think, however, this does show that he has made a pretty clear decision about wanting to position himself and this government to be sort of active on cultural topics. Because, yeah, Oliver Dowden moves from DCMS to the party chair and with some sort of additional cabinet office responsibilities, so therefore further, you know, breaking up the Govian empire. But he is, again, is someone who very much has been really happy to do that, and that is very much where Oliver Dowden's personal politics are. So I think then this does show that the government, yeah, he's, in terms of, yeah, the various things we've been, you know, the prime minister's in two minds, dancing, he's much happier doing the easy culture war stuff than the more kind of contentious, like, you know, taking a knee stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think this is a pretty decisive choice on his part to go, look, this is a government that will be culture war-y.
And also, the way, if you think of this sort of culture war approach as being kind of spearheaded by Muneera Mirza in Number 10, who's a sort of close ally of Boris Johnson, has given this a lot of thought. The way it's always described and her thinking on it is that the Conservative government wants to sort of pitch themselves as the common sense people on culture wars things. And I wonder if, for all that we were sort of saying a minute ago about how Nadine Dorries is seen as a bit eccentric, the difference between her and Oliver Dowden is, I think, that there was a real feeling of Oliver Dowden sort of leaning into this stuff and thinking, like, here is our strategy, and so I'm going to stick my oar in here and here and here and say that this is outrageous, sometimes at points where it didn't feel entirely necessary. And I'm wondering if the approach envisioned by Muneera Mirza is best embodied by someone like Nadine Dorries, who will, I think, quite instinctively be like, that's ridiculous, we shouldn't be tearing this statue down, da-da, and who will be able to sort of do media rounds on it, and it will just be entirely from her natural political instincts. And so you'll get probably roughly the same thing as you were getting with Oliver Dowden, but maybe with a more authentic spokesperson.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
So today's question is actually aimed at Stephen, but we'll all discuss it. You've interviewed Keir Starmer for this week's magazine. And so our readers just want to know sort of what you learnt from him and what you did with him and what it was like. So you kind of went on the road with him as part of his tour of getting around the country, which he was doing over the summer. And I think someone that you spoke to, a Labour MP, said it was his self-criticism tour.
Yeah, the self-criticism tour, which, yeah, it was... yeah, so I went on the road with him for a day in Swindon. He's doing these 3-day visits. He did visits like this when he became head of the Crown Prosecution Service. He genuinely does seem to get a lot out of them. Yeah, clear. Well, it's one of those weird things where I'm not going to lie and say that I came away with a clearer personal understanding of why he enjoys doing this, but yeah, he very much is like, yeah, this is, yeah, as he explained in the piece, then this, yeah, kind of, this is about, yeah, getting the idea. Yeah,
did you have a bad time in Swindon, Stephen?
I mean, I'm not really an early morning person. Please do subscribe to my free morning email. I'm not really a morning person, and I guess also I suspect this is actually one of the ancient journalist and politician divides, right? Politicians are people, right? They like being out and about. I think actually the list of politicians who you're not left more impressed by up close is, you know, it's basically a list which, you know, I was about to like make a potentially libelous joke about, you know, it ends with someone's first name and starts with their surname. But basically, I don't think I would be able to come up with a list of more than five. And, you know, if you know, more than 5 million people subscribe to my Patreon for my legal fees, I will name all five. But I'm very much not a people person. And I therefore, you know, find this all, you know, you're angry with the Labour Party. I mean, yeah, okay, cool. I mean, isn't everyone? But yeah, it was about, yeah, him going around, you know, talking about his ideas, preparing for the conference season, talking about his political thought, just trying to get a sense of, you know, kind of the question that I think it is fair to say is still a bit of enigma to most people, which is, you know, like, who is Keir Starmer? What's he about? You know, what's his approach? Can it possibly work? You know, all that jazz. So I spent time with him in Swindon. I interviewed him sort of afterwards, talking about various things we'd heard. And then, you know, then the result really the real victim of this piece has been Alva, who obviously chairs an office with me in Parliament, has had to deal an awful lot of me, like, sometimes groaning and passing my laptop over and going, how is this bad, Jim? Sometimes, yeah, like, just not even word, just like shoving it along. But yeah, so that's you know, the key. I think the other thing that's interesting about it is I did feel at the end that I had a better idea of what he stood for than I did at the beginning. Unkind listeners may want to go like, that wouldn't have been difficult. But the thing I think is interesting is it does feel really Miliband-y, as in Ed, obviously. Yeah, and now, you know, his ratings are now, you know, once again, you know, entering the Cameron zone. They are, you know, significantly better than Ed Miliband's. He obviously has a load of political advantages that Ed Miliband didn't have. So I accept that it's arguable than a more effective Labour machine, you know, a leader with a stronger chin. And, you know, also, right, the fact that we have had a decade more of cuts, the climate crisis is worse, right? I accept that it's possible that that approach can work. And from an intellectual perspective, I'm quite interested to see if it can, right? But, you know, I mean, I imagine, you know, you, Anoush, is like another person in this office who, you know, bears the scars of covering that period. Probably like me, like a little bit dubious, but it's very hard not to be impressed like by most politicians up close. And he was, you know, he did not become number six on that entry. So
okay, yeah. So yeah, I mean, going back to the Miliband-y thing, I think it was interesting because you asked him a question that he didn't like in your interview, which was, are you more like Tony Blair or Jeremy Corbyn? Which is a really good question because he takes elements of both, doesn't he? And of course, your conclusion was that he was more Miliband-y. How did he react to you sort of suggesting that that was his more of his kind of tradition?
Although I realised the way I've written it seemed like he kind of like, you know, kind of curled up his nose. Yeah, the bit where he got kind of sort of angry and grumpy was actually the sort of, he got very angry and grumpy several times about, not really me, but the idea that, you know, people kind of go like, I know you all say that this thing about Boris Johnson is priced in, but, you know, it shouldn't be, which, you know, it's not unreasonable. But the thing he actually, you know, got sort of kind of objected to was when I went, but look, isn't Kwasi Kwarteng saying a lot of these? And he kind of, you know, interjected and went, well, he's doing sod all. And was, you know, like very sort of forceful about the fact he was doing sod all. But with that, he was just like, well, look, people ask me this all the time. I just think the context is really different. And then, you know, obviously at that point, I spent a lot of time watching him talking to like various people on this tour. And, you know, his sort of preoccupations and he would be returning to over and over again were the quality of work rather than the quantity, right? Essentially, okay, yeah, there's a lot of job vacancies in the United Kingdom, but they ain't good jobs. the climate crisis and mental health, which of course everyone forgets that Ed Miliband was the first party leader to say, look, this is actually, you know, the great untackled health challenge of our time. And so I kind of said, well, look, these things are obviously very important to you. These things were, if you asked someone to give them the sort of potted pricey of the Miliband project, they would be it. That story ended in defeat. Why is Yorkshire going to end any differently? And he just once again responded with the same answer he gave, which is, well, I think the context is different, which is arguable. But what I think is interesting about it is that the thing which really, you know, if you want to give someone on the right of the Labour Party a seizure, you just, like, you know, walk up to them and kind of whisper in their ear, Ed Miliband was just ahead of his time. He was too early. And they're like, it wasn't too early. He was just wrong. And I think it did feel very much to me than his answer, yeah, kind of in a more sort of diplomatic, I lead a party where I know that there are people whose support I need to keep on side, you know, do sort of break out in hives when you suggest Ed Miliband was, you know, just too early. But I think it did feel very much in his argument, well, we're all, the challenges you face is different in different contexts, is basically going, well, look, yeah, but like, what's that bit in Back to the Future? Maybe you're not ready for this song yet, but your kids are going to love it, right? It's very much sort of that with the kind of centrepiece approaches of the Miliband era.
And that's so interesting as well that you mentioned the Keir Starmer's response to you mentioning Kwasi Kwarteng taking up some of those causes from the Miliband era, and the way he said, "Oh, he's doing sod all about it and getting angry." Because I mean, readers can go and look. That's exactly how Ed Miliband, not the same words, but pretty much the same words, to the same issue when I interviewed Ed Miliband a few months ago. You know, I think Ed Miliband said something like, Kwasi Kwarteng has had a Damascene conversion to workers' rights, but he's going to do nothing about it. Don't know how I wrote it in the piece. But, you know, very similar to Keir Starmer's response. And I just thought that was so telling. You know, a few paragraphs after you were exploring the question of how similar Keir Starmer was to Ed Miliband, because I completely accept that maybe most Labour politicians would respond that way if you get onto that topic, but I think that that is just, you know, that is the fruit of clearly a lot of conversations between Keir Starmer and Ed Miliband. I would just be very comfortable concluding that. I think you see that all the time with politicians. You can see like little phrases peppered across one person's speech because they speak a lot to another person. And I wonder if it's a moment like that, that the presence of Ed Miliband in the shadow cabinet is really interesting. You know, that we're having this conversation about whether he is like Ed Miliband, but Ed Miliband is right there, right at the centre of it, kind of trying not to make a fuss and you know, trying not to become the face of this. But, you know, he's still quite central to this project. And so this idea, it's not just the style, but in the substance or even the quite literal people involved. Ed Miliband's still involved in this project. But the question I wanted to ask you, Stephen, about this was, I mean, there's quite a lot on this in the piece, but is your impression after Keir Starmer's first year that he thinks he has learned some lessons from, for example, how Hartlepool went, how that reshuffle went, not just in terms of he clearly knew that he had to take action of some kind, but even the way that action didn't go quite right. Do you think that there's an awareness there of things that he could have done better?
I think the two things I was really struck by is, one, his kind of like fairly sort of, yeah, sort of rock solid certainty, right? There's yeah, let's face it, right? There's an incredible amount of bad air around this project in Westminster and sort of in the kind of general narrative. Now, it's true to say that in the polls that bad air does seem to be lessening a bit, although given that I think it is also hard to argue that lessening has anything to do with anything the Labour Party has said or done, I wouldn't necessarily expect anyone to gain any additional confidence from that one way or the other. But he has this incredible sort of, yeah, calmness and almost stillness about him, yeah, this kind of like, I'm going to set this out in my time, I'm going to do this. But of course, some of the things that he wants to do differently are very much things that he has directly reflected on them having gone wrong, right? So yeah, there is absolutely this kind of weird paradox of, you know, kind of incredible sort of calmness. Yeah, one person, yeah, one shadow cabinet ally said to me, you know, he clearly feels so much better because he feels like he has, you know, better people around him. He's in a calmer, more, you know, he's in a better place. But of course, if one feels better about having better people around you when you hired both sets of people, you've had to do some reflecting on, like, how you ended up in that position. Not least that, is it an episode of the NS podcast where we talk about Labour if we don't come round to the Shadow Chancellor issue? I think, you know, I think even he would acknowledge that the fact that they made a bunch of appointments and it turned out that where they weren't as politically aligned as they perhaps thought they were is a bit of a reflection on him. So yeah, he is. I mean, I really didn't want to use the cliche older, but older and wiser, partly because I always feel wiser implies a level of finality than perhaps might turn out to be discredited by events. But yeah, I think he is aware that it's been a learning experience. Still found someone very early on in their political life, really, in lots of ways, which kind of always weirds me out. But yeah, it was this kind of sense, and he'd kind of gone, actually, yeah, reshuffle could have been handled better. The approach in the year one could have been handled better. And now, of course, he thinks and he has, got the secret sauce. And then, we're all going to see a different side, as, he kept using the phrase opening up, right? As society opens up, politics opens up. Yeah, he does have this kind of, incredible sense of confidence. As I say, as the final thing, the question is we're all going to discover is this sense of confidence well earned?
Well, it's a great interview, and it's in the print magazine this week, where readers can find the full write-up, and also there's a great photo at the beginning, and also a sort of a fun inset picture with the full spectrum of Keir Starmer emotion. There are about like 20 small pictures of him with various expressions, so it's worth buying the print magazine just for that alone.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shekelian, and my colleagues Alva Ray and Stephen Bush. We're produced by Chris Stone, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks so much for listening, and don't forget to leave us a review and subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.